The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
Eagle, joined by my producer, Brendan Thomas. Brendan, what's on your radar today?
All right. What does the Bible say about drinking alcohol specifically?
Well, you know, the very first miracle that Jesus did was changing water into wine. I know that's somewhat of an obvious answer. Probably a lot of people listening were guessing. Now, people have tried to get around that. They said, oh, well, that was not fermented wine. Yes, it was, because notice there's this little passage there. What they would do in those days is they would go ahead and they would bring out the unfermented wine. They did have unfermented wine, or wine that hadn't fermented very well. They would bring that out later in the party, when people were so drunk they couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah.
And we have that comment where they said, boy, usually people give their best wine first. You've saved your best wine for later. That's proof right there that it was fermented wine. The Bible does say, Brendan, that it's a sin to get drunk.
Okay.
When somebody is drunk, they are out of control. When somebody is drunk, and this could apply to being out of control on drugs too, we open up our minds to demonic spirits, and all kinds of bad spiritual things happen to us when we're out of control. But in moderation, there's nothing wrong with it. Jesus drank wine. Wine is simply not forbidden in Scripture.
Okay.
Or any kind of alcoholic
beverage. Similar to gambling being not a sin, but an addiction to it.
Exactly. As a general rule, things in excess are a sin. Things in moderation are not a sin. That's the general rule. There's exceptions, but that would be the general rule.
Understood. Okay. Now to another really... Now this one's going to get into some really fun areas here.
We're done with the serious. We move on to the fun part of the Bible.
Get to the fun stuff. What does the Bible say about dinosaurs? Now, it may seem like a silly question, but...
Not a single word. Now, there is reference to a creature called the Leviathan. He's mentioned in the book of Job. And when you look at the description, it does sound to some people like a dinosaur. Obviously, the relevance of this is that evolutionists have been teaching that dinosaurs lived millions, if not billions of years before human beings. And of course, those that believe in a younger Earth, creation scientists, will say that human beings and dinosaurs were here at the same time. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to settle this, just watch the Flintstones. Clearly see Fred and Dino and the people, and it's the most accurate representation. You can just settle the whole thing, right? No, but here's what's interesting, and I'm no scientist, but on the cave walls of some of the cavemen, we actually see carvings of dinosaurs. We see brontosauruses and things like that. So they seemed to be familiar with them. There are times, even in this slide, like look at some of the reports on the Loch Ness Monster, we see situations where people make those kinds of claims. Obviously, the high majority of those things have died off and they're not around anymore.
Thank goodness.
But could human beings and dinosaurs have lived at the same time? It's possible. Now, I'm not a six-day creationist, but I'm going to tell you something. The people who believe in a younger Earth make a much more compelling argument than people give them credit for, and I think they should be heard out. If you're somebody that doesn't believe in a literal six-day creation, that's fine. That doesn't really contradict the way the book of Genesis was written, but it is very possible that there were some human beings who witnessed dinosaurs. We seem to have a record of that.
Okay.
So that's all I can say on that. But the Bible doesn't mention the word dinosaur. That passage about the Leviathan is the closest. Some have tried to extrapolate that that might be referring to a dinosaur. If not, we're certainly talking about some kind of monstrous creature that was similar to a dinosaur.
So I'm not familiar with that. So what was the Leviathan like described as in the Bible?
Well, as I'm recalling it, it did sound like a huge reptilian being of some sort. Also, look how many mythologies, and obviously we call mythology mythology, mythology for a reason. We don't believe it. Mm-hmm. But a lot of myths are based on a kernel of truth. We have all kinds of accounts of knights fighting dragons and things. There just seems to be this time in history when those kinds of creatures existed. But again, the Leviathan's describing a kind of generic monster, and it's not specific enough to give us a full picture. But it's very possible that if the Bible is referencing a dinosaur anywhere, it would be in that passage in Job.
Okay, understood.
You only need to listen to this radio program once to figure out that Bob has very strong opinions on a wide variety of issues. But one of Bob's strongest passions is freedom of speech itself, even when such speech challenges his own convictions. So feel free to send Bob a comment or a thought-provoking question. You can reach Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions at bobsiegel.net.
Do pets and animals go to heaven? I'm very interested in your answer on this one.
Yeah, well, and of course, we all get very attached to pets. Part of my answer is, if there is a heaven and a hell for pets, I've owned some cats that I'm sure must be in hell right now. Cats don't seem to have any of the redeeming virtues that dogs do, although I'm actually a cat lover, and it's their lack of redeeming virtues that I find.
I know what you mean. I have two cats at my place, and man, they could annoy me sometimes, but at the same time...
Not as much as we annoy them, apparently. They have the most annoyed looks on their faces.
But I still enjoy their presence all the time.
I get a real kick out of them, and their lack of virtues are kind of endearing to me. But certainly dogs have all the loyalty and the qualities. I have heard, Brendan, for years, pastors say, well, pets and animals don't go to heaven because they don't have souls. Now, I hear Christians saying these things. I hear pastors saying these things. And I always ask, what scripture are you using? And they don't have anything. The Bible is very clear on how human beings are saved. There's nothing in the Bible about the salvation of animals. However, the great Christian writer and philosopher C.S. Lewis came up with a very interesting idea. He felt that since we were made in the image of God, there's something like a procreation that happens with us. Now, part of that is obvious. Human beings can become parents and have their own kids, and then people can build machines or paint paintings or write books. That would be a kind of procreation too. But he stretched that in his book, The Problem with Pain. C.S. Lewis has a chapter called Animal Pain. And I would encourage everybody, even if you don't want to read that whole book, to take a look at that chapter. He feels that animals that human beings developed a rapport with, something spiritual may have taken place. It's interesting because for years, zoologists and people that study animals, they never felt that pets were worth studying. They felt that animals should be studied in their natural habitat. And it's unfortunate because for years, people were talking about the personalities of pets. And it's possible that animals around human beings are developing personalities because they are around human beings. So here's the way I look at it. You had a favorite dog. You had a favorite pet. Your dog has passed away.
Right.
Then you're going to heaven. God loves you. You love your dog. How hard would it be for God to just resurrect your dog just because he loves you? How hard would that be for him, and what would be his reason for not doing it? It makes sense to me that he could do it. Mm-hmm. It makes sense to me that he would do it. That does not mean that every canine creature in the world, going back to the wolves and the wild things in the jungles and forests, are going to get resurrected, but perhaps just the animals that were important to human beings. That's speculation, and a lot of that's based on the speculation of C.S. Lewis, which I found very intriguing. But if you want a bone-knuckle answer from the Bible does not say a word about whether our pets go to heaven or not. I'm inclined to believe that they will.
Okay. So in other words, just to double check with you, pets will go to heaven, but wild animals, in your interpretation, will not, if that's the case?
I can't say whether wild animals would or would not, but the theory here is that animals that are important to us that we developed a rapport with may get resurrected and go into heaven, and God may not necessarily have a reason for resurrecting the other animals, the wild animals.
Understood. Okay.
I'm certainly hoping that snakes and lizards won't be there. I'm not really particularly
fond
of them.
If it's anything with my wife, it's got to be no mice, no frogs.
Oh, I like mice. Frogs. I liked frogs when I was a kid, but usually it's animals with fur that I like. Not tarantulas so much. Mammals. Mammals, rodents, I like them.
And God, please let us know. No tarantulas.
I would be just delighted if those freaking things are not there.
All right. My last Bible question for you is, what does the Bible say about tattoos? I have seen plenty of tattoos referencing different Bible verses and things of that nature. Does the Bible say anything at all about tattoos, whether they're sinful to have or other nature of that?
The Bible does not say that tattoos are a sin as we understand tattoos. The reason people get tattoos today, they want some kind of memento. There are passages in the Law of Moses that talk against putting a mark on the skin, but we need to understand that that kind of marking, this gets back again to the ancient Canaanites' religion. Those kinds of marks were associated with the worshiping of pagan false idol deities. And so God had reasons for people not putting on a mark back in those days. It meant something very different. It's not the same as somebody that has a heart on there and says, I'm in love with my girlfriend Bubbles and her sister Peaches. It's very, very different than what they were talking about there in the Bible.
Okay, so tattoos are totally okay in our Christian...
Well, it would depend on the type of tattoo. If a tattoo was saying something vulgar or evil, if somebody was having a tattoo of a swastika put on, certainly those tattoos are wrong. But like we always say, the tattoo is neutral. Mm-hmm. The kind of tattoo, the reason for the tattoo, the motive for the tattoo, that's what we want to be careful of.
Understood. All righty. Well, that concludes my Bible questions. Thank you so much for this
two-part
series.
Yes. Bob Siegel here to talk about my latest book, The Many Myths About Ministry. As you know, I'm a Christian apologist, but let me tell you something. In my many years of interactions with skeptics, doubters, and even seekers, I have found that the vast majority of their problems with Christianity stem from previous church experiences. Yes, what's more, many of their concerns are valid and serve as inspiration for this book. While defending the truth of the Bible and the importance of the gospel message, I nevertheless take an honest look at the way Christians interact with each other. From the larger issues of putting our leaders on too high a pedestal, to the unfair judging of the way another person worships, to the unsolicited advice which claims to have been led by the Spirit of God. Of course, and I do believe the Spirit of God speaks, I do, but a lot of times Christians are putting words in his mouth. Who are we kidding? My friends, this simple, easy read will strike a chord of familiarity with anyone involved in church life. It's a call to lay aside the unimportant issues that distract us and return to the heart of Christian community.
The Many Myths About Ministry by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
In my many years of visiting universities as an apologetic speaker and debater, I have found that there are really only a handful of questions ever shot forth by students. Now, certainly many tangents come up in religious conversations, but the variations stem from very few objections, and you will find that the same questions pop up over and over again. Actually, the questions are fair and painfully honest. For everyone asked in a pompous way, there is always another asked with sincerity. But all too often, Christians shy away from such scrutiny, feeling defensive or under the gun. But I want to ask you, my friends, is there really a need for all this paranoia? After all, if only a few questions are being asked, and if good answers really are out there, we should welcome the opportunity to share. Remember, Christians are telling people that their view of the world is the true view of the world, or God's view of the world. It would not be fair to make such statements without backing them up. But it's not enough to simply welcome questions. Indeed, I would like to see Christians get in the habit of raising their own questions, challenging skeptics to reconsider their own worldviews. You see, everybody has a worldview, whether they admit it or not. If people are religious, that religion affects their values. If somebody subscribes to a certain philosophy like rationalism, humanism, communism, or socialism, that too is a worldview. And it isn't always quite so obvious. Many of my atheist friends proudly brag about how they have removed unnecessary beliefs from their lives. But the truth is, atheism is very much a worldview. Some even call it a religious worldview because it makes ultimate statements about reality supported only by faith. Faith that life is filled with randomness and chance. Faith that moral absolutes do not really exist, but are rather the inventions of some accidental creatures who just happen to evolve by a luck of the draw. Such viewpoints affect the way they look at ethics, politics, and life itself. Many philosophies sound so intellectual that you may feel unqualified to confront them without being a scholar of some sort. But my friends, anyone can ask questions. Just ask questions. Simple questions, even about a subject totally unfamiliar to you. Rest assured, most of the people asking you to defend the Bible know absolutely nothing about the Bible. They may have gone to some website. They may think they know some things about the Bible. They may have a vague recollection of their experience at church. But a lot of them, and there are exceptions, a lot of them really don't know what they're talking about. So it works both ways. Allow me to introduce three very simple but very effective questions. When you use them, you will find yourself doing what I always do, making the obvious obvious. You will literally see your friend's worldview unravel right before your eyes. In fact, it could happen so quickly and so effectively that you may need to pay special attention to your tone and manner just to make sure this surgery is done with gentleness. Remember, you had the same questions yourself one time. Remember, you made the same kinds of statements about Christianity yourself one time. Now, these questions I'm about to share with you, I can't take credit for them. They've been used by Christian apologists for years. In fact, they are very ancient, and they even predate Christianity itself. They are called the Three Questions of Socrates, or the Socratic Method. Question one, what do you mean? Now, when we read Socrates' dialogues preserved for us by Plato, at some point he was always asking one of these three questions I'm about to share. The first one, what do you mean? Most people tend to repeat popular ideas that they've heard without taking the time to really think about their meaning. But a nice-sounding phrase can crack to pieces under the light of scrutiny. For example, much as people enjoy saying that all religions basically teach the same thing, the truth is, two different people can use the same term, God, and mean completely different things by the term. When Christians use the word God, they mean the God of the universe, a thinking, feeling entity who created the universe, who holds each of us accountable. But there's a much different and very popular idea of God, the notion that God in the universe are actually the same thing. In other words, God is everything. This idea, commonly called pantheism, is gaining quite a following in modern religious thought, what's commonly called New Age thought, even though there's really nothing new about it. Its roots go back to certain sects of ancient Hinduism. A Christian says that God made that tree. A pantheist says that God is the tree. We couldn't possibly have two more distinctly opposite views of God. Now, equating God with nature may sound nice. Well, it's not that God made the forest. God is the forest. It's not that God made the sunset. God is the sunset. It's not that God made the weather. God is the weather. He's the rain, the lightning, the thunder. He's the crystal clear water which pours over every smooth stone in the Bonnie Brook. Doesn't that sound nice? It's almost poetic. Here's the problem. When we say that God is everything, we must admit that everything is a pretty big word. Everything includes, well, everything. When somebody tells me that God is everything, I reply, well, you mean I'm God? Your God? Is my wristwatch God? Am I wearing God on my wrist? When I eat a hamburger, am I eating God? When I have my morning coffee, am I drinking God? When I empty the wastebasket, am I tossing God in the trash can? If I walk down the street and step into somebody's discarded gum, am I scraping God off my shoe? And at this time I hear, oh, no, 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 no. I don't mean that all those things are God. You don't? Well, are those things part of God? No, no, no. Oh, I see. I see. Okay, well then, when you say that God is everything, what do you mean? And they will make the horrifying discovery that they had no idea what they meant. It just sounded good. Here's a common statement. I believe in the teachings of Jesus, but I don't believe in organized religion. Sound familiar? If everyone lived a life like Jesus, the world would be a better place, of course. But all this nonsense about going to church, evangelizing, telling people to accept Christ, well, I have a problem with that. And I always say, well, what do you mean? Do you mean you've studied the teachings of Jesus? My friends, 9 out of 10 times, I can guarantee you they don't mean that. There's always exceptions to all of this, but I'm talking in generalities. 9 out of 10 times, they don't mean that. They have not studied the teachings of Jesus. I go on, I said, well, do you mean Jesus never taught anything about organizing a church? Jesus didn't command us to preach the gospel? Actually, Jesus did all those things. You see, the very things people complain about are the teachings of Jesus, and yet they're claiming to believe in his teachings. What do you mean? That is the first of our three questions. The next one is similar in its simplicity. How do you know? And we will examine that question next time on The Bob Siegel Show.
Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the law offices of Matthew Simone.